Black Boy, Disc 2.
Eat your soup or you won't get anything, my mother warned. I looked at her appealingly and couldn't answer. As piece after piece of chicken was eaten, I was unable to eat my soup at all. I grew hot with anger. The preacher was laughing and joking, and the grown-ups were hanging on his words. My growing hate of the preacher finally became more important than God or religion, and I could no longer contain myself. I leaped up from the table, knowing that I should be ashamed of what I was doing, but unable to stop, and screamed, running blindly from the room. "The preacher's gonna eat all the chicken!" I bawled. The preacher tossed back his head and roared with laughter, but my mother was angry and told me that I was to have no dinner because of my bad manners. When I awakened one morning, my mother told me that we were going to see a judge who would make my father support me and my brother. An hour later, all three of us were sitting in a huge, crowded room. I was overwhelmed by the many faces and the voices which I could not understand. High above me was a white face, which my mother told me was the face of the judge. Across the huge room sat my father, smiling confidently, looking at us. My mother warned me not to be fooled by my father's friendly manner. She told me that the judge might ask me questions, and if he did, I must tell him the truth. I agreed, yet I hoped that the judge wouldn't ask me anything. For some reason, the entire thing struck me as being useless. I felt that if my father were going to feed me, then he would have done so regardless of what a judge said to him. And I did not want my father to feed me. I was hungry, but my thoughts of food did not now center about him. I waited, growing restless, hungry. My mother gave me a dry sandwich, and I munched and stared, longing to go home. Finally, I heard my mother's name called. She rose and began weeping so copiously that she couldn't talk for a few moments. At last, she managed to say that her husband had deserted her and her two children, that her children were hungry, that they stayed hungry, that she worked, that she was trying to raise them alone. Then my father was called. He came forward jauntily, smiling. He tried to kiss my mother, but she turned away from him. I only heard one sentence of what he said. "I'm doing all I can, Your Honor," he mumbled, grinning. It had been painful to sit and watch my mother crying and my father laughing, and I was glad when we were outside in the sunny streets. Back at home, my mother wept again and talked complainingly about the unfairness of the judge who had accepted my father's word. After the court scene, I tried to forget my father. I didn't hate him. I simply didn't want to think of him. Often when we were hungry, my mother would beg me to go to my father's job and ask him for a dollar, a dime, a nickel. But I would never consent to go. I didn't want to see him. My mother fell ill, and the problem of food became an acute daily agony. Hunger was with us always. Sometimes the neighbors would feed us, or a dollar bill would come in the mail from my grandmother. It was winter, and I would buy a dime's worth of coal each morning from the corner coal yard and lug it home in paper bags. For a time, I remained out of school to wait upon my mother. Then Granny came to visit us, and I returned to school. At night, there were long, halting discussions about our going to live with Granny, but nothing came of it. Perhaps there wasn't enough money for railroad fare. Angered by having been hauled to court, my father now spurned us completely. I heard long, angry, whispered conversations between my mother and grandmother to the effect that woman ought to be killed for breaking up a home. What irked me was the ceaseless talk and no action. If someone had suggested that my father be killed, I would perhaps have become interested. If someone had suggested that his name never be mentioned, I would no doubt have agreed. If someone had suggested that we move to another city, I would have been glad. But there was only endless talk that led nowhere, and I began to keep away from home as much as possible, preferring the simplicity of the streets to the worried, futile talk at home. Finally, we could no longer pay the rent for our dingy flat. The few dollars that Granny had left us before she went home were gone. Half sick and in despair, my mother made the rounds of the charitable institutions seeking help. She found an orphan home that agreed to assume the guidance of me and my brother, provided my mother worked and made small payments. My mother hated to be separated from us, but she had no choice. The orphan home was a two-story frame building, set amid trees in a wide green field. My mother ushered me and my brother one morning into the building, and into the presence of a tall, gaunt, mulatto woman who called herself Miss Simon. At once, she took a fancy to me, and I was frightened speechless. I was afraid of her the moment I saw her, and my fear lasted during my entire stay in the home. The house was crowded with children, and there was always a storm of noise. The daily routine was blurred to me, and I never quite grasped it. The most abiding feeling I had each day was hunger and fear. The meals were skimpy, and there were only two of them. Just before we went to bed each night, we were given a slice of bread smeared with molasses. The children were silent, hostile, vindictive, continuously complaining of hunger. There was an all-over atmosphere of nervousness and intrigue, of children telling tales upon others, of children being deprived of food to punish them. The home didn't have the money to check the growth of the wide stretches of grass by having it mown, so it had to be pulled by hand. Each morning, after we had eaten a breakfast that seemed like no breakfast at all, an older child would lead a herd of us to the vast lawn, and we would get to our knees and wrench the grass loose from the dirt with our fingers. At intervals, Miss Simon would make a tour of inspection, examining the pile of pulled grass beside each child, scolding or praising according to the size of the pile. Many mornings, I was too weak from hunger to pull the grass. I would grow dizzy, and my mind would become blank, and I would find myself, after an interval of unconsciousness, upon my hands and knees, my head whirling, my eyes staring in bleak astonishment at the green grass, wondering where I was, feeling that I was emerging from a dream. During the first days, my mother came each night to visit me and my brother. Then her visits stopped. I began to wonder if she too, like my father, had disappeared into the unknown. I was rapidly learning to distrust everything and everybody. When my mother did come, I asked her why she had remained away so long, and she told me that Miss Simon had forbidden her to visit us, that Miss Simon had said that she was spoiling us with too much attention. I begged my mother to take me away. She wept and told me to wait, that soon she would take us to Arkansas. She left, and my heart sank. Miss Simon tried to win my confidence. She asked me if I would like to be adopted by her, if my mother consented, and I said no. She would take me into her apartment and talk to me, but her words had no effect. Dread and distrust had already become a daily part of my being, and my memory grew sharp, my senses more impressionable. I began to be aware of myself as a distinct personality striving against others. I held myself in, afraid to act or speak until I was sure of my surroundings, feeling most of the time that I was suspended over a void. My imagination soared. I dreamed of running away. Each morning I vowed that I would leave the next morning. But the next morning always found me afraid. One day, Miss Simon told me that, thereafter, I was to help her in the office. I ate lunch with her, and strangely, when I sat facing her at the table, my hunger vanished. The woman killed something in me. Next, she called me to her desk, where she sat addressing envelopes.
"Step up close to the desk," she said. "Don't be afraid."
I went and stood at her elbow. There was a wart on her chin, and I stared at it.
"Now, take a blotter from over there and blot each envelope after I'm through writing on it," she instructed me,
pointing to a blotter that stood about a foot from my hand. I stared and did not move or answer.
"Take the blotter," she said.
I wanted to reach for the blotter and succeeded only in twitching my arm.
"Here,"
she said sharply, reaching for the blotter and shoving it into my fingers. She wrote in ink on the envelope and pushed it toward me. Holding the blotter in my hand, I stared at the envelope and could not move.
"Blot it," she said.
I couldn't lift my hand. I knew what she had said. I knew what she wanted me to do, and I had heard her correctly. I wanted to look at her and say something, tell her why I couldn't move, but my eyes were fixed upon the floor. I couldn't summon enough courage while she sat there looking at me to reach over the yawning space of 12 inches and blot the wet ink on the envelope.
"Blot it!"
she spoke sharply. Still, I could not move or answer.
"Look at me."
I couldn't lift my eyes. She reached her hand to my face, and I twisted away.
"What's wrong with you?"
she demanded. I began to cry, and she drove me from the room. I decided that as soon as night came, I would run away. The dinner bell rang, and I didn't go to the table, but hid in a corner of the hallway. When I heard the dishes rattling at the table, I opened the door and ran down the walk to the street. Dusk was falling. Doubt made me stop. Ought I go back? No. Hunger was back there, and fear. I went on, coming to concrete sidewalks. People passed me. Where was I going? I didn't know. The farther I walked, the more frantic I became. In a confused and vague way, I knew that I was doing more running away from than running toward something. I stopped. The streets seemed dangerous. The buildings were massive and dark. The moon shone and the trees loomed frighteningly. No, I couldn't go on. I would go back. But I had walked so far and had turned too many corners and hadn't kept track of the direction. Which way led back to the orphan home? I didn't know. I was lost. I stood in the middle of the sidewalk and cried. A white policeman came to me, and I wondered if he was going to beat me. He asked me what was the matter, and I told him that I was trying to find my mother. His white face created a new fear in me. I was remembering the tale of the white man who had beaten the black boy. A crowd gathered, and I was urged to tell where I lived. Curiously, I was too full of fear to cry now. I wanted to tell the white face that I had run off from an orphan home and that Miss Simon ran it, but I was afraid. Finally, I was taken to the police station where I was fed. I felt better. I sat in a big chair where I was surrounded by white policemen, but they seemed to ignore me. Through the window, I could see that night had completely fallen, and that lights now gleamed in the streets. I grew sleepy and dozed. My shoulder was shaken gently, and I opened my eyes and looked into a white face of another policeman who was sitting beside me. He asked me questions in a quiet, confidential tone, and quite before I knew it, he wasn't white anymore. I told him that I had run away from an orphan home and that Miss Simon ran it. It was but a matter of minutes before I was walking alongside a policeman heading toward the home. The policeman led me to the front gate, and I saw Miss Simon waiting for me on the steps. She identified me, and I was left in her charge. I begged her not to beat me, but she yanked me upstairs into an empty room and lashed me thoroughly. Sobbing, I slunk off to bed, resolved to run away again, but I was watched closely after that. My mother was informed upon her next visit that I had tried to run away, and she was terribly upset. "Why did you do it?" she asked. "I don't want to stay here," I told her. "But you must," she said. "How can I work if I'm to worry about you? You must remember that you have no father." "I'm doing all I can." "I don't want to stay here," I repeated. "Then if I take you to your father..." "I don't want to stay with him either," I said. "But I want you to ask him for enough money for us to go to my sister's in Arkansas," she said. Again, I was faced with choices I didn't like, but I finally agreed. After all, my hate for my father wasn't so great and urgent as my hate for the orphan home. My mother held to her idea, and one night, a week or so later, I found myself standing in a room in a frame house. My father and a strange woman were sitting before a bright fire that blazed in a grate. My mother and I were standing about 6 feet away, as though we were afraid to approach them any closer. "It's not for me," my mother was saying. "It's for your children that I'm asking you for money."
"I ain't got nothing," my father said, laughing.
"Come here, boy," the strange woman called to me. I looked at her and didn't move. "Give him a nickel," the woman said. "He's cute."
"Come here, Richard," my father said, stretching out his hand.
I backed away, shaking my head, keeping my eyes on the fire.
"Here's a cute child," the strange woman said.
"You ought to be ashamed," my mother said to the strange woman. "You're starving my children."
"Now don't you all fight," my father said, laughing.
"I'll take that poker and hit you," I blurted at my father.
He looked at my mother and laughed louder.
"You told him to say that," he said.
"Don't say such things, Richard," my mother said.
"You ought to be dead,"
I said to the strange woman. The woman laughed and threw her arms about my father's neck. I grew ashamed and wanted to leave.
"How can you starve your children?" my mother asked.
"Let Richard stay with me," my father said.
"Do you want to stay with your father, Richard?" my mother asked.
"No,"
I said.
"You'll get plenty to eat," he said.
"I'm hungry now," I told him, "but I won't stay with you."
"Aw, give the boy a nickel," the woman said.
My father ran his hand into his pocket and pulled out a nickel.
"Here, Richard," he said.
"Don't take it," my mother said.
"Don't teach him to be a fool," my father said. "Here, Richard, take it."
I looked at my mother, at the strange woman, at my father, then into the fire. I wanted to take the nickel, but I didn't want to take it from my father.
"You ought to be ashamed," my mother said, weeping.
giving your son a nickel when he's hungry. If there's a God, he'll pay you back. That's all I got, my father said, laughing again and returning the nickel to his pocket.
We left. I had the feeling that I had had to do with something unclean. Many times in the years after that, the image of my father and the strange woman, their faces lit by the dancing flames, would surge up in my imagination so vivid and strong that I felt I could reach out and touch it. I would stare at it, feeling that it possessed some vital meaning which always eluded me. A quarter of a century was to elapse between the time when I saw my father sitting with the strange woman and the time when I was to see him again, standing alone upon the red clay of a Mississippi plantation, a sharecropper, clad in ragged overalls, holding a muddy hoe in his gnarled, veined hands. A quarter of a century, during which my mind and consciousness had become so greatly and violently altered that when I tried to talk to him, I realized that though ties of blood made us kin, though I could see a shadow of my face in his face, though there was an echo of my voice in his voice, we were forever strangers, speaking a different language, living on vastly distant planes of reality. That day, a quarter of a century later, when I visited him on the plantation, he was standing against the sky, smiling toothlessly, his hair whitened, his body bent, his eyes glazed with dim recollection, his fearsome aspect of 25 years ago gone forever from him. I was overwhelmed to realize that he could never understand me or the scalding experiences that had swept me beyond his life and into an area of living that he could never know. I stood before him, poised, my mind aching as it embraced the simple nakedness of his life, feeling how completely his soul was imprisoned by the slow flow of the seasons, by wind and rain and sun. How fastened were his memories to a crude and raw past, how chained were his actions and emotions to the direct animalistic impulses of his withering body. From the white landowners above him, there had not been handed to him a chance to learn the meaning of loyalty, of sentiment, of tradition. Joy was as unknown to him as was despair. As a creature of the earth, he endured, hardy, whole, seemingly indestructible, with no regrets and no hope. He asked easy, drawling questions about me, his other son, his wife, and he laughed, amused, when I informed him of their destinies. I forgave him and pitied him as my eyes looked past him to the unpainted wooden shack. From far beyond the horizons that bound this bleak plantation, there had come to me through my living the knowledge that my father was a black peasant who had gone to the city seeking life, but who had failed in the city. A black peasant whose life had been hopelessly snarled in the city, and who had, at last, fled the city. That same city which had lifted me in its burning arms and borne me toward alien and undreamed-of shores of knowing.
Chapter 2. The glad days that dawned gave me liberty for the free play of impulse, and from anxiety and restraint, I leaped to license and thoughtless action. My mother arrived one afternoon with the news that we were going to live with her sister in Elaine, Arkansas, and that en route we would visit Granny, who had moved from Natchez to Jackson, Mississippi. As the words fell from my mother's lips, a long and heavy anxiety lifted from me. Excited, I rushed about and gathered my ragged clothes. I was leaving the hated home. Hunger, fear, leaving days that had been as dark and lonely as death. While I was packing, a playmate came to tell me that one of my shirts was hanging damp upon the clothesline. Filled more with the sense of coming freedom than with generosity, I told him that he could have it. What was a shirt to me now? The children stood about and watched me with envious eyes as I crammed my things into a suitcase, but I didn't notice them. The moment I had learned that I was to leave, my feelings had recoiled so sharply and quickly from the home that the children simply did not exist for me anymore. Their faces possessed the power of evoking in me a million memories that I longed to forget, and instead of my leaving drawing me to them in communion, it had flung me forever beyond them. I was so eager to be gone that when I stood in the front hallway, packed and ready, I didn't even think of saying goodbye to the boys and girls with whom I had eaten and slept and lived for so many weeks. My mother scolded me for my thoughtlessness and bade me say goodbye to them. Reluctantly, I obeyed her, wishing that I didn't have to do so. As I shook the dingy palms extended to me, I kept my eyes averted, not wanting to look again into the faces that hurt me because they had become so thoroughly associated in my feelings with hunger and fear. In shaking hands, I was doing something that I was to do countless times in the years to come, acting in conformity with what others expected of me, even though, by the very nature and form of my life, I didn't and couldn't share their spirit. After I had outlived the shocks of childhood, after the habit of reflection had been born in me, I used to mull over the strange absence of real kindness in Negroes. How unstable was our tenderness, how lacking in genuine passion we were, how void of great hope, how timid our joy, how bare our traditions, how hollow our memories, how lacking we were in those intangible sentiments that bind man to man, and how shallow was even our despair. After I had learned other ways of life, I used to brood upon the unconscious irony of those who felt that Negroes led so passional an existence. I saw that what had been taken for our emotional strength was our negative confusions, our flights, our fears, our frenzy under pressure. Whenever I thought of the essential bleakness of black life in America, I knew that Negroes had never been allowed to catch the full spirit of Western civilization, that they lived somehow in it, but not of it. And when I brooded upon the cultural barrenness of black life, I wondered if clean, positive tenderness, love, honor, loyalty, and the capacity to remember were native with man. I asked myself if these human qualities were not fostered, won, struggled and suffered for, preserved in ritual from one generation to another. Granny's home in Jackson was an enchanting place to explore. It was a two-story frame structure of seven rooms. My brother and I used to play hide-and-seek in the long, narrow hallways and on and under the stairs. Granny's son, Uncle Clark, had bought her this home, and its white-plastered walls, its front and back porches, its round columns and banisters made me feel that surely there was no finer house in all the round world. There were wide green fields in which my brother and I roamed and played and shouted, and there were the timid children of the neighbors, boys and girls to whom my brother and I felt superior in worldly knowledge. We took pride in telling them what it was like to ride on a train, what the yellow, sleepy Mississippi River looked like, how it felt to sail on the Kate Adams, what Memphis looked like, and how I had run off from the orphan home. And we would hint that we were pausing for but a few days and then would be off to even more fabulous places and marvelous experiences. To help support the household, my grandmother boarded a colored schoolteacher, Ella, a young woman with so remote and dreamy and silent a manner that that I was as much afraid of her as I was attracted to her. I had long wanted to ask her to tell me about the books that she was always reading, but I could never quite summon enough courage to do so. One afternoon, I found her sitting alone upon the front porch, reading.
"Ella," I begged, "please, tell me what you're reading."
"It's just a book," she said evasively, looking about with apprehension.
"But what's it about?" I asked.
"Your grandmother wouldn't like it if I talked to you about novels," she told me. I detected a note of sympathy in her voice.
"I don't care,"
I said loudly and bravely.
"Shh, you mustn't say things like that," she said. "But I want to know."
"When you grow up, you'll read books and know what's in them," she explained.
"But I want to know now."
She thought a while, then closed the book. "Come here," she said. I sat at her feet and lifted my face to hers. "Once upon a time, there was an old, old man named Bluebeard," she began in a low voice. She whispered to me the story of Bluebeard and his 7 wives, and I ceased to see the porch, the sunshine, her face, everything. As her words fell upon my new ears, I endowed them with a reality that welled up from somewhere within me. She told how Bluebeard had duped and married 7 wives, how he had loved and slain them, how he had hanged them up by their hair in a dark closet. The tale made the world around me be, throb, live. As she spoke, reality changed. The look of things altered, and the world became peopled with magical presences. My sense of life deepened, and the feel of things was different somehow. Enchanted and enthralled, I stopped her constantly to ask for details. My imagination blazed. The sensations the story aroused in me were never to leave me. When she was about to finish, when my interest was keenest, when I was lost to the world around me, Granny stepped briskly onto the porch.
"You stop that, you evil gal," she shouted. "I want none of that devil stuff in my house."
Her voice jarred me so that I gasped. For a moment, I did not know what was happening.
"I'm sorry, Mrs. Wilson," Ella stammered, rising. "But he asked me..."
"He's just a foolish child, and you know it,"
Granny blazed. Ella bowed her head and went into the house.
"But Granny, she didn't finish,"
I protested, knowing that I should have kept quiet. She bared her teeth and slapped me across my mouth with the back of her hand.
"You shut your mouth," she hissed. "You don't know what you're talking about."
"But I want to hear what happened,"
I wailed, dodging another blow that I thought was coming.
"That's the devil's work," she shouted.
My grandmother was as nearly white as a Negro can get without being white, which means that she was white. The sagging flesh of her face quivered. Her eyes, large, dark, deep-set, wide apart, glared at me. Her lips narrowed to a line. Her high forehead wrinkled. When she was angry, her eyelids drooped halfway down over her pupils, giving her a baleful aspect.
"But I liked the story," I told her.
"You're going to burn in hell,"
she said with such furious conviction that for a moment I believed her. Not to know the end of the tale filled me with a sense of emptiness, loss. I hungered for the sharp, frightening, breathtaking, almost painful excitement that the story had given me, and I vowed that as soon as I was old enough, I would buy all the novels there were and read them to feed that thirst for violence that was in me, for intrigue, for plotting, for secrecy, for bloody murders. So profoundly responsive a chord had the tale struck in me that the threats of my mother and grandmother had no effect whatsoever. They read my insistence as mere obstinacy, as foolishness, something that would quickly pass, and they had no notion how desperately serious the tale had made me. They could not have known that Ella's whispered story of deception and murder had been the first experience in my life that had elicited from me a total emotional response. No words or punishment could have possibly made me doubt. I had tasted what to me was life, and I would have more of it, somehow, some way. I realized that they could not understand what I was feeling, and I kept quiet. But when no one was looking, I would slip into Ella's room and steal a book and take it back of the barn and try to read it. Usually I couldn't decipher enough words to make the story have meaning. I burned to learn to read novels, and I tortured my mother into telling me the meaning of every strange word I saw, not because the word itself had any value, but because it was the gateway to a forbidden and enchanting land. One afternoon, my mother became so ill that she had to go to bed. When night fell, Granny assumed the task of seeing that my brother and I bathed. She set two tubs of water in our room and ordered us to pull off our clothes, which we did. She sat at one end of the room, knitting, lifting her eyes now and then from the wool to watch us and direct us. My brother and I splashed in the water, playing, laughing, trying our utmost to fling suds into each other's eyes. The floor was getting so sloppy that Granny scolded us. "Stop that foolishness and wash yourselves." "Yes, ma'am," we answered automatically and proceeded with our playing. I scooped up a double handful of suds and called to my brother. He looked, and I flung the suds, but he ducked, and the white foam spattered on the floor.
"Richard, stop that playing and bathe."
"Yes, ma'am," I said, watching my brother to catch him unaware so that I could fling more suds at him.
"Come here, you Richard," Granny said, putting her knitting aside.
I went to her, walking sheepishly and nakedly across the floor. She snatched the towel from my hand and began to scrub my ears, my face, my neck.
"Bend over," she ordered.
I stooped and she scrubbed my anus. My mind was in a sort of daze, midway between daydreaming and thinking. Then, before I knew it, words whose meaning I did not fully know, had slipped out of my mouth.
"When you get through, kiss back there," I said,
the words rolling softly but unpremeditatedly. My first indication that something was wrong was that Granny became terribly still. Then she pushed me violently from her. I turned around and saw that her white face was frozen, that her black, deep-set eyes were blazing at me unblinkingly. Taking my cue from her queer expression, I knew that I had said something awful, but I had no notion at that moment just how awful it was. Granny rose, slowly, and lifted the wet towel high above her head and brought it down across my naked back with all the outraged fury of her 60-odd-year-old body, leaving an aching streak of fire burning and quivering on my skin. I gasped and held my breath, fighting against the pain. Then I howled and cringed. I had not realized the meaning of what I had said. Its moral horror was unfelt by me, and her attack seemed without cause. She lifted the wet towel and struck me again, with such force that I dropped to my knees. I knew that if I did not get out of her reach, she would kill me. Naked, I rose and ran out of the room, screaming. My mother hurried from her bed.
"What's the matter, Mama?" she asked Granny.
I lingered in the hallway, trembling, looking at Granny, trying to speak, but only moving my lips. Granny seemed to have gone out of her mind, for she stood like stone, her eyes dead upon me, not saying a word.
"Richard, what have you done?" my mother asked.
Poised to run again, I shook my head.
What's the matter, for God's sake? My mother asked of me, of Granny, of my brother, turning her face from one to the other. Granny wilted, half turned, flung the towel to the floor, then burst into tears.
I was trying to wash him, Granny whimpered. Here, she continued, pointing, and that black little devil.
Her body was shaking with insult and rage.
He told me to kiss him there when I was through.
Now my mother stared without speaking.
No,
my mother exclaimed.
He did, Granny whimpered. He didn't say that,
my mother protested.
He did,
Granny sighed. I listened, vaguely knowing now that I had committed some awful wrong that I couldn't undo, that I had uttered words that I couldn't recall even though I ached to nullify them, kill them, turn back time to the moment before I had talked, so that I could have another chance to save myself. My mother picked up the wet towel and came toward me. I ran into the kitchen, naked, yelling. She came hard upon my heels, and I scuttled into the backyard, running blindly in the dark, butting my head against the fence, the tree, bruising my toes on sticks of wood, still screaming. I had no way of measuring the gravity of my wrong, and I assumed that I had done something for which I would never be forgiven. Had I known just how my words had struck them, I would have remained still and taken my punishment. But it was the feeling that anything could or would happen to me that made me wild with fear.
Come here, you little filthy fool, my mother called.
I dodged her and ran back into the house, then again into the hallway, my naked body flashing frantically through the air. I crouched in a dark corner. My mother rushed upon me, breathing hard. I ducked, crawled, stood, and ran again.
You may as well stand still, my mother said. I'm going to beat you tonight if it's the last thing I do on this earth.
Again she charged me, and I dodged, just missing the stinging swish of the wet towel, and scooted into the room where my brother stood.
What's the matter?
He asked, for he had not heard what I had said. A blow fell on my mouth. I whirled. Granny was upon me. She struck me another blow on my head with the back of her hand. Then my mother came into the room. I fell to the floor and crawled under the bed.
You come out of there, my mother called.
No,
I cried.
Come out, or I'll beat you to within an inch of your life, she said.
No,
I said.
Call Papa,
Granny said. I trembled. Granny was sending my brother to fetch Grandpa, of whom I was mortally afraid. He was a tall, skinny, silent, grim black man who had fought in the Civil War with the Union Army. When he was angry, he gritted his teeth with a terrifying grating sound. He kept his army gun in his room, standing in a corner, loaded. He was under the delusion that the war between the states would be resumed. I heard my brother rush out of the room, and I knew it was but a matter of minutes before Grandpa would come. I bawled myself into a knot and moaned,
No, no, no!
Grandpa came and ordered me from under the bed. I refused to move.
Come out of there, little man,
he said.
No.
Do you want me to get my gun?
No, sir. Please don't shoot me,
I cried.
Then come out.
I remained still. Grandpa took hold of the bed and pulled it. I clung to a bedpost and was dragged over the floor. Grandpa ran at me and tried to grab my leg, but I crawled out of reach. I rested on all fours and kept in the center of the bed, and each time the bed moved, I moved, following it.
Come out and get your whipping, my mother called.
I remained still. The bed moved, and I moved. I did not think, I did not plan. I did not plot. Instinct told me what to do. There was painful danger, and I had to avoid it. Grandpa finally gave up and went back to his room.
When you come out, you'll get your whipping, my mother said. No matter how long you stay under there, you're going to get it. And no food for you tonight.
What did he do?
My brother asked.
Something he ought to be killed for, Granny said.
But what?
My brother asked.
Shut you up and get to bed, my mother said.
I stayed under the bed, far into the night. The household went to sleep. Finally, hunger and thirst drove me out. When I stood up, I found my mother lurking in the doorway, waiting for me.
Come into the kitchen, she said.
I followed her, and she beat me. But she did not use the wet towel. Grandpa had forbade that. Between strokes of the switch, she would ask me where I had learned the dirty words, and I could not tell her. And my inability to tell her made her furious.
I'm going to beat you until you tell me, she declared.
And I couldn't tell her, because I didn't know. None of the obscene words I'd learned at school in Memphis had dealt with perversions of any sort, although I might have learned the words while loitering drunkenly in saloons. The next day, Granny said emphatically that she knew who had ruined me, that she knew I had learned about foul practices from reading Ella's books. And when I asked what foul practices were, my mother beat me afresh. No matter how hard I tried to convince them that I hadn't read the words in a book, or that I couldn't remember having heard anyone say them, they wouldn't believe me. Granny finally charged Ella with telling me things I shouldn't know, and Ella, weeping and distraught, packed her things and moved. The tremendous upheaval that my words had caused made me know that there lay back of them much more than I could figure out, and I resolved that in the future I would learn the meaning of why they had beat and denounced me. The days and hours began to speak now with a clearer tongue. Each experience had a sharp meaning of its own. There was the breathlessly anxious fun of chasing and catching flitting fireflies on drowsy summer nights. There was the drenching hospitality in the pervading smell of sweet magnolias. There was the aura of limitless freedom distilled from the rolling sweep of tall green grass swaying and glinting in the wind and sun. There was the pitying chuckle that bubbled in my throat when I watched a fat duck waddle across the backyard. There was the suspense I felt when I heard the taut, sharp song of a yellow-black bee hovering nervously but patiently above a white rose. There was the drugged, sleepy feeling that came from sipping glasses of milk, drinking them slowly so that they would last a long time, and drinking enough for the first time in my life. There was the bitter amusement of going into town with Granny and watching the baffled stares of white folks who saw an old white woman leading two undeniably Negro boys in and out of stores on Capitol Street. There was the slow, fresh, saliva-stimulating smell of cooking cotton seeds. There was the excitement of fishing in muddy country creeks with my grandpa on cloudy days. There was the fear and awe I felt when Grandpa took me to a sawmill to watch the giant whirring steel blades whine and scream as they bit into wet green logs. There was the puckery taste that almost made me cry when I ate my first half-ripe persimmon. There was the greedy joy in the tangy taste of wild hickory nuts. There was the dry, hot summer morning when I scratched my bare arms on briars while picking blackberries and came home with my fingers and lips stained black with sweet berry juice. There was the relish of eating my first fried fish sandwich, nibbling at it slowly
and hoping that I would never eat it up. There was the all-night ache in my stomach after I had climbed a neighbor's tree and eaten stolen, unripe peaches. There was the morning when I thought I would fall dead from fear after I had stepped with my bare feet upon a bright little green garden snake. And there were the long, slow, drowsy days and nights of drizzling rain. At last, we were at the railroad station with our bags, waiting for the train that would take us to Arkansas. And for the first time, I noticed that there were two lines of people at the ticket window, a white line and a black line. During my visit at Granny's, a sense of the two races had been born in me with a sharp concreteness that would never die until I died. When I boarded the train, I was aware that we Negroes were in one part of the train and that the whites were in the other. Naively, I wanted to go and see how the whites looked while sitting in their part of the train. "Can I go and peep at the white folks?" I asked my mother. "You keep quiet," she said. "But that wouldn't be wrong, would it?" "Well, you keep still." "But why can't I?" "Quit talking foolishness." I had begun to notice that my mother became irritated when I questioned her about whites and blacks, and I couldn't quite understand it. I wanted to understand these two sets of people who lived side by side and never touched, it seemed, except in violence. Now there was my grandmother. Was she white? Just how white was she? What did the whites think of her whiteness? "Mama, is Granny white?" I asked as the train rolled through the darkness. "If you've got eyes, you can see what color she is," my mother said. "I mean, do the white folks think she's white?" "Why don't you ask the white folks that?" she countered. "But you know," I insisted. "Why should I know?" she asked. "I'm not white." "Granny looks white," I said, hoping to establish one fact at least. "Then why is she living with us colored folks?" "Don't you want Granny to live with us?" she asked, blunting my question. "Yes." "Then why are you asking?" "I want to know." "Doesn't Granny live with us?" "Yes." "Isn't that enough?" "But does she want to live with us?" "Why didn't you ask Granny that?" my mother evaded me again in a taunting voice. "Did Granny become colored when she married Grandpa?" "Will you stop asking silly questions?" "But did she?" "Granny didn't become colored," my mother said angrily. "She was born the color she is now." Again, I was being shut out of the secret, the thing, the reality I felt somewhere beneath all the words and silences. "Why didn't Granny marry a white man?" I asked. "Because she didn't want to," my mother said peevishly. "Why don't you want to talk to me?" I asked. She slapped me, and I cried. Later, grudgingly, she told me that Granny came of Irish, Scotch, and French stock, in which Negro blood had somewhere and somehow been infused. She explained it all in a matter-of-fact, offhand, neutral way. Her emotions were not involved at all.
"What was Granny's name before she married Grandpa?"
"Bolden."
"Who gave her that name?"
"The white man who owned her."
"She was a slave?"
"Yes."
"And Bolden was the name of Granny's father?"
"Granny doesn't know who her father was."
"So they just gave her any name?"
"They gave her a name, that's all I know."
"Couldn't Granny find out who her father was?"
"For what, silly?"
"So she could know."
"Know for what?"
"Just to know."
"But for what?" I could not say. I could not get anywhere.
"Mama, where did Father get his name?"
From his father? And where did the father of my father get his name? Like Granny got hers, from a white man? Do they know who he is?
I don't know.
Why don't they find out?
For what?
My mother demanded harshly. And I could think of no rational or practical reason why my father should try to find out who his father's father was.
What has Papa got in him?
I asked. Some white and some red and some black, she said.
Indian, white, and Negro?
Yes.
Then what am I?
They'll call you a colored man when you grow up, she said. Then she turned to me and smiled mockingly and asked, Do you mind, Mr. Wright? I was angry, and I didn't answer. I didn't object to being called colored, but I knew that there was something my mother was holding back. She wasn't concealing facts, but feelings, attitudes, convictions, which she didn't want me to know. And she became angry when I prodded her. All right. I would find out someday. Just wait. All right. I was colored. It was fine. I didn't know enough to be afraid or to anticipate in a concrete manner. True, I'd heard that colored people were killed and beaten, but so far, it all seemed remote. There was, of course, a vague uneasiness about it all. But I would be able to handle that when I came to it. It would be simple. If anybody tried to kill me, then I would kill them first. When we arrived at Elaine, I saw that Aunt Maggie lived in a bungalow that had a fence around it. It looked like home, and I was glad. I had no suspicion that I was to live here for but a short time, and that the manner of my leaving would be my first baptism of racial emotion. A wide, dusty road ran past the house, and on each side of the road, wild flowers grew. It was summer, and the smell of clay dust was everywhere, day and night. I would get up early every morning to wade with my bare feet through the dust of the road, reveling in the strange mixture of the cold, dew-wet crust on top of the road, and the warm, sun-baked dust beneath. After sunrise, the bees would come out, and I discovered that by slapping my two palms together smartly, I could kill a bee. My mother warned me to stop, telling me that bees made honey, that it was not good to kill things that made food, that I would eventually be stung. But I felt confident of outwitting any bee. One morning, I slapped an enormous bee between my hands, just as it had lit upon a flower, and it stung me in the tender center of my left palm. I ran home screaming. Good enough for you, my mother commented dryly. I never crushed any more bees. Aunt Maggie's husband, Uncle Hoskins, owned a saloon that catered to the hundreds of Negroes who worked in the surrounding sawmills. Remembering the saloon of my Memphis days, I begged Uncle Hoskins to take me to see it, and he promised. But my mother said no. She was afraid that I would grow up to be a drunkard if I went inside of a saloon again while still a child. Well, if I could not see the saloon, at least I could eat. And at mealtime, Aunt Maggie's table was so loaded with food that I could scarcely believe it was real. It took me some time to get used to the idea of there being enough to eat. I felt that if I ate enough, there would not be anything left for another time. When I first sat down at Aunt Maggie's table, I couldn't eat until I had asked, Can I eat all I want?
Eat as much as you'd like, Uncle Hoskins said.
I didn't believe him. I ate until my stomach hurt, but even then, I didn't want to get up from the table.
Your eyes are bigger than your stomach, my mother said.
Let him eat all he wants to and get used to food, Uncle Hoskins said.
When supper was over, I saw that there were many biscuits piled high upon the bread platter,
an astonishing and unbelievable sight to me. Though the biscuits were right before my eyes, and though there was more flour in the kitchen, I was apprehensive lest there be no bread for breakfast in the morning. I was afraid that somehow the biscuits might disappear during the night while I was sleeping. I did not want to wake up in the morning, as I had so often in the past, feeling hungry and knowing that there was no food in the house. So surreptitiously, I took some of the biscuits from the platter and slipped them into my pocket, not to eat, but to keep as a bulwark against any possible attack of hunger. Even after I had got used to seeing the table loaded with food at each meal, I still stole bread and put it into my pockets. In washing my clothes, my mother found the gummy wads and scolded me to break me of the habit. I stopped hiding the bread in my pockets and hid it about the house, in corners, behind dressers. I didn't break the habit of stealing and hoarding bread until my faith that food would be forthcoming at each meal had been somewhat established. Uncle Hoskins had a horse and buggy, and sometimes he used to take me with him to Helena, where he traded. One day, when I was riding with him, he said, "Richard, would you like to see this horse drink water out of the middle of the river?" "Yes," I said, laughing. "But this horse can't do that." "Yes, he can," Uncle Hoskins said. "Just wait and see." He lashed the horse and headed the buggy straight for the Mississippi River.
"Where are you going?"
I asked, alarm mounting in me.
"We're going to the middle of the river so the horse can drink," he said.
He drove over the levee and down the long slope of cobblestones to the river's edge, and the horse plunged wildly in. I looked at the mile stretch of water that lay ahead and leaped up in terror.
"No!"
I screamed.
"This horse has to drink," Uncle Hoskins said grimly.
"The river's deep," I shouted.
"The horse can't drink here,"
Uncle Hoskins said, lashing the back of the struggling animal. The buggy went farther. The horse slowed a little and tossed his head above the current. I grabbed the sides of the buggy, ready to jump, even though I could not swim.
This ends Disc 2.